We are one of the few brands that produces everything in-house. And even though we have the traditional way of glass making where we make it by hand, mouth blown, we also operate our own machines with our own technology.
Maximilian Riedel's eponymous Austrian glassware firm has been setting tables with success since the 1750s. The CEO spills the secrets of keeping manufacturing at home and how our tastes are changing today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also today, a word with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, on entertaining. Plus,
I think my philosophy really was to try to keep the company quite small and special rather than going mainstream and churning out and selling to department stores.
A word with the scion, son and designer behind the made-in-the-UK cutlery brand par excellence, David Meller. Also, we'll get a lesson in learning your Jacobsens from your Yules with the director of the Design Museum of Denmark. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, with the holiday season in near view and Santa's sleigh careening ever closer, we've turned our attention to one of the simple pleasures of the season, entertaining and decoding design around the dining room table. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll whet appetites by telling a few tales of the brands you should have on your table and debunking a few false rules for setting up a dinner party. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined in studio now to start the discussion by Monocle's very own editor-in-chief and a very genteel entertainer, if I may say so, Tyler Brulé.
How are you?
I'm very well indeed, and I think it's quite an apt time to be discussing laying a table. You know, we're pretty close to Christmas. I won't tell people exactly when it is, but we're in birthday season as well.
We're in birthday season, absolutely. I won't be laying the table for my birthday, hopefully not. But no, you're right, and there's a lot of tables to be considered all over the place, whether it is one or two events that we're going to be having here. Some are of a sit-down scale, some are not. And then, of course, there's all the personal pursuits beyond that.
And in the last issue of the magazine, we put out to tender the question of how to lay a table, and we got lots of excellent answers. But I'm going to grill you personally on a few rules and a few faux pas. Are you a man that likes a big centerpiece in the middle of a table?
I like a centerpiece by day, but then centerpiece needs to move. So I think you have to consider that if you've got a dining room table and your dining room is a bit of a statement and people are coming in for cocktails at the start of the season and there's going to be 45 minutes to an hour of mingling, I think it's fine for the centerpiece to be there, but then it has to make a graceful exit at a certain point, for
okay.
sure.
Okay, well, that's an excellent rule of thumb. I want to know also if we're, you know, towards the end of the year, I think we might be reaching peak wooden table. I think dining rooms are getting so loud. I think that we've got enough concrete floors going on to knock the din about. Is it time we settled in with a good tablecloth now and again?
Absolutely. A good tablecloth, also with a good underpad, a good felt underpad. I'm a huge believer in this. And I think also when we consider tables, you know, it's obviously a little bit late for some. But, you know, also I see a lot of people who will go to a catering company because they've got more relatives than they thought. More friends might be sort of pitching up over the holidays. And so sometimes you want to have a bit of a reconsideration. One thing I did recently when I worked on a house was I really sort of specified a table which was deliberately narrow. Because I think one of the other things that's happened is that the dining table has just become, you know, far too broad. And I think, you know, really great tables are really ones where you can get maybe two placemats with maybe half a width in between them. And that's it. There needs to be enough room for a plate. There needs to be, you know, if it's sharing dishes, whatever you're doing, obviously, you know, room for those. But, you know, but then also that's why you have sideboards as well. So you don't have to get everything on the table. But I like the idea that there is proper intimacy and people aren't sitting meters away from each other.
And I like a good rounded edge as well. If you need to get an extra family member, crowbar them on, don't sit them on the corner.
No.
Rounded edge.
Yeah, you need a rounded edge. But I think also just, and you were talking, you know, at the top of your question, was that question of acoustics as well. And I think you want a bit of sort of cozy surrounds that you want to sort of feel that sort of almost deafening sort of feeling that you get when there's a great snowfall as well. And hopefully that descends over the dining scenario.
And in the Danish wool-clad surrounds of beautiful Studio 2 here at Midori House, it's hard to believe that we are in a light crisis where the world continues to be far too bright and unflattering. What are the rules for a dinner party? Are you good for a candle? Are you good
I'm good for a really good Svensk 10 low-rise candelabra at the center of the table. So, you know, maybe three good candles. And then I found a really, really good Lobmeier chandelier. I'm sure people are sort of getting a vision of something very different, but it is a chandelier.
Well, you're in a big dining hall. I can see it now.
1950s, came out of a shoe store in Vienna, so it's mostly painted metalwork and then with obviously a lot of Lobmeier crystal on it. But it's modernist. It's not a huge statement piece, but boy, does it dim beautifully. So I think that sort of suspended above the table, a few candles, a little bit of ambient light around, but dimmers, and more dimmers is absolutely key. And that's one of the amazing things, in this world of LED. And LED, we must admit, it has improved. But be careful, when you look at the label, because I thought, I'm going to get some new LED lights when I was in Switzerland a few weeks ago. And then you realize that not all LEDs are even dimmable. I don't know how we arrived at this place where everyone is pushing this technology on us. We've been dimming for decades. I'm sure we've been dimming for a century at this point. And yet, at the same time, there is just, it's a real sort of crisis when you get to the Haushaltung shop, certainly if you're in the Germanic world. And I even despair more for people, who aren't in that world, because one of the great things about Switzerland is there's a company, write this down, ladies and gentlemen, there's a company called Rigi, and we've done a story about them. But because Switzerland sits outside of the EU, you can still get proper filament bulbs.
So getting the light right is a huge priority. And just my final question for you, Tyler. I wonder when you are entertaining people at...
Music? We're coming to music? Or no?
At Chez Brulé, yeah, absolutely. What is the... do you have the tinny hi-hats of a sort of jazz track in the background? What's the...
Well, hopefully not tinny hi-hat. I mean, and this is the other problem, right? Just the tinniness that comes through from playing off devices which just don't deliver enough oomph. And that's, that's from source. So one of the things is I'd love having, of course, a really bassy track in the background. There is a lot of Christmas music in my house for sure. But most from source, it mostly comes from CDs. And that's, one of the great things. I'd love going to Japan at this time of year, because you go into HMV, you go into Tower Records. I mean, look at these names from the past. You go into Tsutaya, and there's just a massive Christmas section. And who knew that the Carpenters' Christmas album could be reinvented again and again, not just by Korean boy bands, but by every version of every type of Japanese female group with at least 48 members as well. So there's always a good Christmas soundtrack strumming along in the background.
So you're not averse to a Christmas jingle? I think some people might be surprised to
hear
that.
No, I love a Christmas jingle. I love Christmas.
And that was Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, taking us through the finer points of design around the dining table and a few hints for hosting this winter. Now, a quick aside, as we pick a few design-minded products we'd suggest plumping for to furnish a Yuletide table, or maybe to buy a new one. The reissue of an iconic piece of furniture needs to be true to the original designer's intent, and it's just this that makes the CH23 dining chair by Hans J. Wegner so charming. Danish furniture producer Carl Hansen & Son, the CEO of whom we'll hear from a little later, has mastered this process and brought back the 1950 creation. Available in oak and walnut finishes with a meticulous detailing of the double-woven seat that's true to the original, plus light, sturdy, dashing and timeless to boot. Keeping in the retro revival vein, we've also sprung for a German-made Mittgard Fettersurlichter lamp, a product of a century-old company from West Germany. The Fettersurlichter, meaning spring-loaded lamp, itself also dates from 1950 and features a black retro shade and is available as a table, wall, ceiling or floor lamp. Finally, we head to Japan, where firms Legnatech and Hirata have been making furniture for rural houses for a full half century. It was Singaporean product designer Gabriel Tan who saw the potential to turn the brand's wares into a design company with appeal beyond its national borders. The collaboration soon turned into an ambitious 18-piece collection, and Ariake's white oak, hinoki and cedar tables, plus cabinets, shelves and chairs are tinted with dyed ash and hatched over an intensive week-long workshop in the town of Moridomi in Japan. For more of our favourite finds, do consult our Christmas gift guide in the December-January issue of the magazine. And remember that the metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch with our producer. Fearless as he is, it's Ben Ryland, and he can be contacted at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. As the 11th generation CEO and president of one of the most esteemed names in glassware, Maximilian Riedel has great design pedigree, but isn't one for looking backwards for inspiration. It's been nearly 45 years since the company introduced the first of its grape-specific range of glasses, named the Sommelier Series. Since then, Riedel has partnered with prestigious designers and winemakers, and even taken the humble champagne flute to task. But how does a company established in the 18th century stay ahead of the curve? Well, I spoke to Maximilian to find out a little more.
Neither my father nor my grandfather was truly interested in the history, because my grandfather obviously suffered during the World Wars and lost everything because we were Sudeten Germans. So we had our business and operations in Czech Republic. And so he was obviously not interested digging in the past. And my father is a man, a personality who looks only into the future and deals with the presence. And I, being always asked, you're the 11th generation, how do you feel about history? I did my research and I went back and opened a museum and proper filed the history because I wanted that the future generations know exactly where we come from, who we are and what we do.
And I suppose an interesting thing is that although you can look to the past for inspiration, the conditions, economic and social, change over time. So you've got to be reactive. I wonder how, since 2013, you've tried to shape the company up and make it a modern company that is capable of dealing with the strictures of operating in an extremely competitive market. And one, I might add, that has a tremendous amount of outsourcing in. You've been very loyal to the history of the brand. How important was that?
So when I came back from the United States, obviously I adopted a certain style of management, which is so different than what was celebrated and conducted in our company. I've surrounded myself with a new team, very young, enthusiastic people, and I try to keep them enthusiastic. So for me, the people are a good reason to be happy and go with a smile to work. And with them, I'm planting the roads for the future. What we face, obviously, are changes, constant changes. When you say I'm being somewhat influenced by the past, even though we shouldn't forget the past, no matter in what kind of industry, there's always retrospective. I mean, we were just seeing Versace, and she put on the supermodels from the past, dressing them in gowns from Gianni Versace, and the whole fashion industry raved about it. So it's not bad sometimes to go into your archives and see what was done good in the past, and maybe you can learn from it. As you say, the market is very competitive, so how do we deal with competition? First of all, we have to be a step ahead, not only in terms of design and functionality, but also how we produce our product, because we are one of the few brands that produces everything in-house. And even though we have the traditional way of glass making where we make it by hand, mouth blown, we also operate our own machines with our own technology. The glass industry is a fairly small industry, so you cannot go into what I would call a supermarket and buy a new machinery. You have to develop it from scratch. And we again surround ourselves with a very impressive team of technicians that help us to stay ahead of the competition. Nowadays, it's not only driven by design and function, but also by the price. Glass is being made around the world, and we are producing in the heart of Europe. So labor is very expensive, and the only way to deal with it is invest in machinery that produces quality at a high output.
And design, industrial design particularly, can be a bit of a bellwether of the time when it's consumed. You can kind of read in the stem of a glass or in the thickness of a lip the cultures and the customs of the times. I wonder how the physical products have changed over the years and what kind of sectors you're eyeing up. Do people eat at home more or less, and you have to adjust to that with the way that you physically design these products?
I opened this year in the honor of producing glass now in our factory in Kufstein since 60 years, what I call the glass cabinet, what other people would call a think tank. And there I show products that we have produced there in the last 60 years. And to my surprise, the collection is complete, even though nobody ever cared about it. And what you can see is the change of time. Glasses then were parts of decoration and decorating your table. The glasses had to coordinate with your flatware, with your plates, with the decor. Then we worked with companies like Rosenthal, for example, who were the number one German producer of porcelain. The company was a very wealthy company, went out of business, has changed hands many times just because they didn't see the writing on the wall. You cannot stick to something that the people are not interested in anymore. And my father was the genius who 40 years ago in this regard decided to leave and move away from decorating your table and producing glasses for a sole purpose, to enhance the aroma of wine and spirits. And form follows function. This is the idea of the Bauhaus, and this is exactly why we are continuing to be successful, is we are focusing on the content of what we put into the glass versus the design of the glass itself. And if you nowadays listen to music, you obviously have your headset from Beats or other companies. And so what I would like to compare my product to is a loudspeaker, and a very good loudspeaker. And what my job is to communicate proper the content of aroma in any kind of wine, any kind of grape, any kind of spirit, going from Daiginjo all the way to single malt whiskey. And this is how we have gained the trust of the industry. So what we do is we work very close with the winemakers, and with them we develop our glasses. So we do not do this with designers. When I'm talking about the Riedel brand, we operate many brands next to Riedel. One is Nachtmann, one is Spiegelau. But when we talk about Riedel, we are producing tools for those who enjoy a good glass of wine.
That was Maximilian Riedel, president and CEO of glassmaker extraordinaire Riedel. Now, the late David Meller is rightly famed for his fine cutlery, but his industrial design chops extended to bus shelters and even traffic lights. The trained silversmith, however, is best known for shaping the way we eat and the utensils we eat with since the late 1960s. Today, the company David Meller Design is headed by his son, Corin Meller, who's overseen the expansion of the empire his father left with new shops and a devotion to keeping the manufacturing of these products right here in the UK. I asked Corin how it all started.
It all started really back in the 50s, actually, when my father went to the Royal College of Art in London. And he designed his first range of cutlery called Pride. That really was the starting point of David Meller Design. That actual design was the first design from the RCA to actually go into manufacture, and it was picked up by a big Sheffield cutlery firm called Walker & Hall. I mean, it was very much of that 50s era of, I suppose, Britain can make it, strikingly modern, and it was really quite a brave move, really, of this traditional manufacturer to pick this very striking modern range of cutlery.
And your father trained as a silversmith, if I'm not mistaken. Did that somehow inform his idea of design? Did, you know, that almost seems to me like he's coming from a kind of an older world, a different sensibility, a different kind of time. But maybe the way that the designs ended up kind of pushed that forward.
He actually specialised in silver pieces, but his designs were far more wide-ranging, and he did actually lots of industrial design. One of his sort of most iconic designs is the traffic lights that you stop at every day. Silversmithing was what he sort of really started with, but his scope was much, much wider than silver.
And Britain can make it. That's an interesting echo through the ages, particularly today where people are considering, for the most part, reshoring their manufacturing, having sent it off to China 10 or 20 years ago for the saved costs. But you guys have a beautiful factory in the Peak District, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right. We started actually manufacturing in the 70s in Sheffield, and then in 1990 we commissioned Michael Hopkins to design a purpose-built building, and that building really became a sort of early Hopkins design, which then really went on to form the basis for the Glyndebourne Opera House. You know, manufacturing really was an absolute core of what we did. I mean, my father was always a maker. I'm a maker. I love making things. I'm always in the factory. I can't actually resist even helping with the cutlery production. And making, to me, is an incredibly important part. I use really making through in the design process, but then also actually manufacturing a product, you know, I think is a very valuable thing to do these days.
And one that's not done as much as it could be here in the UK, I fear. You took over as creative director around 10 years ago, and your father sadly passed away in 2009. I suppose there are a lot of things to think about in terms of keeping the business forward moving and honouring, I suppose, some of the DNA of yourself, but also of the kind of the design How did you go about that? How was the succession kind of managed and thought through?
Well, I worked with my father for probably 10 or 20 years or so, really, before his death. So, I mean, I was always sort of the other silent half, I suppose. So it was quite easy to just sort of really carrying on what we were doing. I think my philosophy really was to try to keep the company quite small and special rather than going mainstream and churning out and selling to department stores. So we went the opposite way, really, and decided to sort of just be more specialist. The other real main idea I had was we were known for actually cutlery. And in our shops, we'd hold a whole variety of different products that we've selected from other manufacturers. And gradually, we've been starting to actually find people to make things other than cutlery. So obviously, we manufacture the cutlery, but now we have glass-made woodware, metalwork. So we've really sort of expanded really what we do, but then kept the focus on making what we're good at making.
And making things for the table, which we'll come back to in a moment for maybe a few recommendations, given the time of year and given your expertise in it. But making other things has been a big hallmark of your work as well. I'm thinking, of course, of suspended glass bridges at Sheffield Hallam University. I'm thinking of decorative benches for the Duke of Devonshire at Chatsworth House. When you think about your designs, is there anything that you won't turn your hand to? Or, you know,
I generally do design for our company, and then other things sort of just seem to sort of come along. You know, I find that quite exciting. And that might be pieces of silver, or it might be as big as a bridge that we did for Sheffield Hallam University. I will stretch myself, but I won't go out of my comfort zone. I mean, I like really rigid materials. I love wood. I love metal. So long as it sort of fits into those remits, I mean, I think you have to know where your boundaries are. Otherwise, I think you just become a bit of a mishmash of a designer.
Corin Mellor there, creative director of David Mellor Design. And if you are in the Marylebone area, do visit their new shop just off Marylebone High Street, right here in London. Now, good designing may mostly be about what's on the table, but the table itself and the surroundings are also key ingredients to a decent meal. Few nations have done more to create smart surrounds than the Danish, however. From the Model 49 chair by Eric Buch and Hans J. Wegner's beloved wishbone model, a little Danish design can lift the drabbest of interiors. But there's life beyond the better-known names that form the modernist oeuvre, and that's exactly the premise behind a new exhibition, paying tribute to the lesser-known names behind the canon. Anne-Louise Sommer is director of the Design Museum of Denmark. Erik Knut Hansen is the CEO of furniture maker Carl Hansen & Son. They spoke to Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles.
I'm Knut Erik Hansen. I'm a third generation owner of Carl Hansen & Son in Denmark. We produce furniture in an island in Denmark called Funen. We have a factory now which is one of the most modern in Europe at about 22,000 square meters now, about 350 people working there. Our architects are all the, basically without any exception, the golden age Danish architects like Wegner, Kjærholm, Kåre Klint, and so on.
I'm Anne-Louise Sommer, and I'm a museum director at the Design Museum Denmark in Copenhagen. And I've been there for a little more than 6 years.
And what has brought you two together today?
Oh, the proud tradition of Danish design, I should say. Yeah. Danish furniture design.
Why did you feel it was the right time to do this now?
Well, you see, Kåre Klint perhaps is not too well known in UK, and the history behind the Danish furniture, I find, is very important to get out, to get people to understand what is behind all the pieces of furniture that is produced today. And therefore, you have to have the history.
And one of the interesting things, it seems, about Kåre Klint's work in an English context is that some of his earliest designs was actually inspired, in a way, by British design. Can you share that with us?
That is correct. It's simplified. And this is where I think Anne-Louise can speak more than I can, but he was, of course, a master in simplifying the design that was the basic of what he created. And I think that is what has been going on as a process all the way up till today.
It'd be great to hear about that process, because it was the 1920s, so it was quite early days for, I guess, Danish modern. How was he interpreting these British designs? Tell us a little bit about the process.
I can start with a quote by Kåre Klint himself. He said that a good chair should be of a good old family. And that sort of embrace the whole philosophy, you might say, design philosophy, how he approached the design process. So he started by looking carefully at all the historical types of furniture, typologies, and then he went almost scientific to the furniture. By first he was drawing and measuring, and then he sort of got into the core of the previous furnitures, and then he started on this kind of enlightened level to create something new. So he thought that a chair from, for instance, 18th century, Chippendale chair, for instance, it should be pushed forward to the 20th century. And it was a different society. It was different ways of dealing with production methods and material. But you could still have the proud old story, the legacy of the form, the shape, and the understanding of the material. And then he did, as Knud Erik just said, he simplified or he refined. And he thought that in modern time, we didn't need all these ornaments. It should be sort of not stripped bare, but almost stripped bare, like you can also see in the Central European modernism, also in the 20s. But it was a different take because he praised the tradition and kept the tradition alive. So that was his very important contribution to the design history.
So there was a little bit of really recognizing the past, where designers at the time maybe trying to just move away altogether. Mm-hmm. Was his approach a little bit more caring and appreciative of what's come before?
Yes, much more. And you can say that when he did something which was new, it was always something which went hand in hand with the tradition. So it was tradition and innovation at the same time in a very subtle way. And I also think it's a kind of humble approach, because you're not just standing at a cross-section or border or whatever, and then you look to the past and it's terrible and you want to create something completely new. No, you know that you are just having an understanding of tradition where everyone is standing on the shoulders of the predecessors, and you take the best and you move forward. And that was his guiding principles as a teacher, as a professor at the Royal Academy, where he became professor eventually.
You see his work, you work with his pieces, and you're manufacturing them, and then you're also manufacturing pieces by, I guess, his students and the designers that came after him. Where does Klint's work fit in there? How did he kind of inspire this next generation?
I think you can easily see it in Paul Kerholm, in Ole Wangscher, what they did in their design, and in fact all his pupils, Borge Mogensen, very much so. All his measurements, all his angles, everything that he kind of indoctrinated them with, mm-hmm. is going on. And that perhaps was also limiting their fantasy a little bit, because they were really true to what he had taught them. Whereas you can see when you go on to Wegener, that he dropped out, and his design is different. Perhaps his fantasy was, he's broader in his fantasy in the way he has created his furniture. And I think that's very interesting.
The Design Museum of Denmark's Anne-Louise Sommer and Erik Knud Hansen, speaking to Monocle's Nolan Giles there. Next week, step on your favourite boots and pour yourself a nip of Glühwein. We're warming up for a winter with a selection of smart stocking fillers.
I've been wanting to make shoes for women for my family's company since I knew how to tie a shoe. You know, Dad, come on, why don't you make a women's shoe? Make something that I want to wear.
That was the story of Red Wing Boots, coming up next week. And if you're in London, do join us for the annual Monocle Christmas Market this weekend, December the 3rd and 4th, that is, right here at Midori House in Marylebone. Section D is produced by Ben Ryland and edited by Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.